are the antidote to right-wing radio, RadioLeft.com.
In my country, a group of religious extremists are reshaping the government to promote their own agenda and morality.
The government can keep a list of everyone I call, and they do not need a judge's permission.
Our citizens are seized and held in prison without being charged of a crime, without the right to a trial, and without a lawyer. Why should you care about what is happening to my country?
Because my country is the United States of America.
Where investigative bloggers meet the media. It's Blog Call on RadioLeft.com. And this is Jeff Staples in the Radio Left studios for another edition of Blog Call. It's presented by Democrats.com, RadioLeft.com, and a number of other organizations. Today's guest will be Greg Palast of GregPalast.com. He is going to be introduced by Bob Furtick of Democrats.com. Go ahead, Bob.
Thank you, Jeff. The goal of Blog Call is simple, to build a bridge between progressive investigative bloggers and the mainstream media. By creating a non-adversarial relationship, we hope to get mainstream media coverage of the most important and well-documented exposés by bloggers. Last week's call featured John Byrne and Larissa Alexandrovna of RawStory.com, who exposed Tom DeLay's relationship with a casino lobbyist named Jack Abramoff and a shadowy network of right-wing direct mail scammers. After last Tuesday's call, Tom DeLay suddenly became the self-appointed champion of Terry Schiavo in a naked effort to fire up the religious right and to take the spotlight off his numerous scandals. The mainstream media fell for DeLay's diversion, hook, line, and sinker. Even though an overwhelming majority of Americans strongly opposed DeLay's efforts to force Congress into the middle of a tragic and painful family dispute. Will the mainstream media stop investigating DeLay's enormous scandals to keep him in power? Progressive bloggers are watching. Today is Blog Call 4, and our featured guest is Greg Palast. Palast is one of the most important investigative reporters in the world, but he's barely known in his home country because he's blacked out by the mainstream media. Among progressive activists, Palast is best known for his expose of the phony felon purge in Florida before the 2000 presidential election. This purge under Secretary of State Katherine Harris illegally disenfranchised tens of thousands of voters, most of whom were Democrats. It was crucial to George Bush's theft of the 2000 elections, but most Americans have never heard of it because the mainstream media, led by the New York Times, has refused to report it. This week marks the second anniversary of Bush's invasion of Iraq. So far, 1,524 U.S. soldiers have died, over 10,000 have been maimed, and over 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. U.S. taxpayers have spent $300 billion, and our occupation will continue for years, if not decades, to come, because Bush is building 14 permanent military bases, another story the mainstream media refuses to report. 2 years ago, Bush insisted Iraq was an urgent threat to the U.S. because Saddam had WMDs, including nuclear weapons. In January, we learned the hunt for WMDs was over, and everything we were told was a big lie. So why did we really invade Iraq? According to Greg Palast's new expose, top officials in the Bush administration began planning to steal Iraq's oil within weeks of stealing the White House in January 2001, 9 full months before 9/11. Palast reveals a behind-the-scenes battle between two powerful forces, the neocons who wanted to privatize Iraq's oil and greatly increase production to destroy OPEC, and the oil giants who wanted to keep OPEC and keep Iraq's state-owned oil company, but just wanted to change its management so they could get the lion's share of Iraq's oil export business. The neocons won the battle at first, and Bush signed an executive order in 2002 to privatize Iraq's oil. But this outraged the Iraqi people and greatly fueled the insurgency, which the neocons never expected. According to Palast, the oil giants ultimately won this battle within the Bush administration, which is why neocon Paul Wolfowitz is leaving the Pentagon. Palast's expose relies on sources who are directly involved in this battle, sources who have gone on the record and on camera with Palast. Palast reported the story on the BBC and in Harper's Magazine and on his blog, but it has received virtually no coverage in the mainstream media. We're here to try to change that today. Greg will present his story in greater detail for 15 minutes, then take questions for another 30 minutes. Go ahead, Greg.
mention a couple things that while I enjoy being, as the Village Voice says, a cult journalist in the United States, I am the mainstream from the rest of the world's point of view. The report I'm about to tell you was first broadcast a couple of nights ago, actually this past Thursday night on BBC's flagship current affairs nightly program, Newsnight, out of London. That is the world's mainstream from the world's number one news network. It is not covered in the U.S. The story is more fully explained in the April edition of Harper's OPEC on the March is the name of the article, and that came out this morning. Just to give you a little bit of the information, including what's neither in the BBC piece nor in Harper's, so I have the luxury of the latest and the full information. And you'll see more also on our website, gregpalast.com, where you can also catch the BBC film. The story is basically about an internal war which is affecting our current policy between the neocons on one side and lined up with right-wing elements in the Pentagon, such as Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Fife, and on the other side, the State Department and its friends in OPEC and the oil industry. And we begin with some very interesting information, which is that despite what we picked up through the gossip of Bob Woodward's book, that Colin Powell and gang were not favorable to invading Iraq. In fact, within weeks of the Bush first inauguration in February 2001, there were meetings held, organized by the State Department and NSC, to plan the invasion of Iraq. And the host of one of the first meetings out in California was Fallah al-Jabouri, who is an advisor to Hess Oil Trading, Goldman Sachs, an Iraqi exile who was also advisor to OPEC. And Fallah, F-A-L-A-H, had hosted these meetings with the discussion was of an invasion that would look like a coup d'etat, that only Saddam would be toppled and the Ba'athists would stay in power. So it was not a competition of whether there should or shouldn't be an invasion of Iraq. It was a question of what type of invasion. The State Department guy is not favoring occupation, just cut off the head, in and out in 3 days, as Fallah explained, two or 3 days of martial law, everyone stays in position, nothing changes except the guy, the dictator with the mustache. After September 11th, neocon power rose, and a document for recreating Iraq, the economy of Iraq, into a kind of free market miracle in Mesopotamia was drafted to privatize, quote, all state assets. Now, I want to credit the Wall Street Journal for first taking note of this document, which also called for privatizing the entire oil industry, selling off all the oil fields. Quite extraordinary. That didn't happen, and I was very interested in why that didn't happen. And I should also note that BBC reported last year, a report that I did for BBC television, is that Jay Garner said that one of the reasons he was forced to leave, based on that information, was that he did not go along with this plan for privatization, especially the oil fields. He thought that that would foment insurgency, and to use his fields, we'd make more enemies than we started with. There was more than Jay Garner dissenting from this privatization plan, which was implemented to a great extent by Paul Bremer when he came in as kind of the U.S. Pasha for Iraq. And they did privatize much, from banks to other industries, but not the oil fields. That's because Philip Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, who was the former CEO of Shell Oil USA and chairman of Fluor Corporation, a big contractor like Halliburton, he was sent in by the Bush administration to basically run the oil industry of Iraq for the Iraqis. He would have none of the privatization plan, nor would his hand-picked successor, Rob McKee, that's M little C capital K double E, Rob McKee, who had been senior vice president of ConocoPhillips Oil. And the oil industry was none too happy about privatization, which might strike some people as unusual. Their concern was, number one, The idea behind privatization was crafted at the Heritage Foundation by a guy named Ari Cohn with the intent of destroying OPEC and bringing down the power of the Saudis. Now, destroying OPEC is not high on the list of oil company goals, because after all, we're looking at 200 to 400% increases for all the major oil companies in profits because of this $50 barrel oil that's out there. So basically, big oil loves OPEC, and they're not going to do anything that'll undercut it. Second, privatization, as explained to us by Amy Jaffe, the James Baker Institute, who plays an important role in this, is not liked by the oil industry because it's the cronies of the oil, people like Ahmed Chalabi, who tended to favor privatization, who would pick up the oil fields, not the big oil companies, who prefer to work with state oil industries friendly to OPEC that give them profit-sharing agreements, as in places like Azerbaijan. We have, by the way, Rob McKee, while he was the guy that our administration put in to run the U.S. oil fields after Carroll, while he left ConocoPhillips Oil, he remained chairman of a Halliburton subsidiary during that period. December of 2003, a report was secretly being crafted which would reverse the positions proposed in the year earlier report calling for privatization of the oil fields. This was a plan, a set of options, which was crafted under the guidance of Amy Jaffe at the James Baker Institute. And of course, James Baker, as you know, represents the Saudi Arabian government. He represents Exxon Oil, et cetera, which gave a bunch of options to the Iraqi oil ministry for seven types of various state-owned oil industries. So it was all state oil industries, no complete quickie sell-off for privatization. The industry did not like privatization. In fact, as we showed on BBC television, Ari Cohn at the Heritage Foundation, who was livid about the reversal of privatization and called it a witch's brew of Arab economists, Saudis, and those in the State Department backing Russia, which also is backed by OPEC, which also benefits from OPEC's high prices. It was Ari Cohn who said that the neocons' privatization plan was a no-brainer, and of course it was a great benefit to the Western economy, so it was a no-brainer. And Phil Carroll, CEO, ex-CEO Shell, told me, yeah, it's a no-brainer, all right, anyone who backs privatization of the oil in Iraq has no brains. And obviously there's no love lost there. So there's a secret report, 323 pages long, which gave detailed ideas to the Iraqi ministry of how to divide up, how to divide the industry, run it all through state control, which would create something that the U.S. industry wanted. At first, by the way, the State Department denied that this document existed, the oil options plan for Iraq existed. Jaffe inadvertently gave me the information, we filed BBC and Harper's Magazine and Rolling Stone, by the way, filed Freedom of Information Act requests, and finally, after 6 months of cajoling and threatening, they coughed up the actual document, which we have. And they still will not acknowledge exactly who the authors are, et cetera, except we knew that industry consultants were key to the write-up. Hello? Switching phone sets here. And so what we have is a story of war between neocons and the oil industry within the administration. It's been hidden. Secret reports, first to divide up and sell off Iraq's oil, and now to set up an OPEC-friendly state oil company, and which would also be friendly towards the U.S. oil industry. We have plans going back from the earliest days of the administration, obviously before September 11th. To invade Iraq and replace its leadership. And we also have, by the way, information that I've picked up in this whole discussion that Paul Wolfowitz, when he testified to Congress, saying that there's enough oil in Iraq to pay for the reconstruction of Iraq, which had been listed by others as costing $100 billion. We now know that that's a low figure to occupy Iraq. That, in fact, the guys like Bob Ebel, Guy Caruso, who were advising the Pentagon, never gave Wolfowitz information that would allow him to make such a statement. So the question is, was Wolfowitz being optimistic? Was he just being wrong? Or was he perjuring himself by countering the technical information he was given? I mean, it's worth further investigation. And in fact, we know from Robert, from Bob Ebel, who was the man sent by the U.S. government to babysit Ahmed Chalabi and his team of oil guys, that that Ebel was very adamant that the numbers going out were way too optimistic on oil production, but he kept that to himself. That's not a minor point, because the so-called kind of free ride, the cheap cost of the war, was one of its selling points. I don't think Congress would have, it's hard to say Congress would have gone along for an attack on Iraq if they'd known that the tab for this feast would run above $200 billion. So I'll be happy to take any questions. I don't know if I can give you all the answers.
Okay, well, Greg, thank you. I just want to announce this call is being recorded by Jeff Staples of RadioLeft.com, and you can listen tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Then it will be permanently archived at WhiteRoseSociety.org, the Internet's finest archive of liberal and progressive political talk radio. Thank you, Ben Birch, and WhiteRoseSociety.org. We will now begin 30 minutes of Q&A, then stay on for 5 more minutes of general announcements. Press 6 to be heard, and then press 6 again to listen to the response. Go ahead.
Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question for Greg. This is Mike Hirsch from MikeHirsch.com.
Okay.
How can we go about getting you a regular column in, syndicated column, if that's something that you'd be interested in doing?
Take hostages. I did have a column in the premier paper of Britain, the Sunday Observer, which is the Sunday paper of The Guardian. And I gave that up with much reluctance, but I'd love to see. Obviously, it would be nice to have a major Sunday newspaper column in the United States. But I'm happy just to say that Harper's Magazine is offering me space as a contributing editor. But for the most part, investigative reporting is pretty much dead. I mean, my style is the old, you know, I think my guiding light and my idol is Jack Anderson, and the great man. And that type of investigative continuing column, I don't think has a space in the United States anymore.
Well, I'm on the steering committee of a group in Montgomery County, Maryland, with about 2,000 members, and we could lean heavily on the Washington Post to give you like a weekly or monthly space. And I don't know if they'll respond to that, but we can try.
I doubt if the Post could be leaned on. I wouldn't want them to be leaned on. I would want them I would hope that they would kiss me because they love me.
Okay, let's try and keep this conversation focused on the content of the story.
Let's talk about the content.
Next question.
This is Ralph Trautman.
Yes.
Hi.
Ralph, you're with?
I'm with the Group of Independent Weblogs.
Okay.
Greg, I'm trying to extract from this story some kind of overall narrative of how and why we went to Iraq. And two sort of major areas of questions occur to me. One, is this, have we now in effect found out what Dick Cheney's task force was doing?
Well, this is very interesting. My information, and I still have to double check this, is Dick Cheney met with oil company executives and went over the oil field maps of Iraq. My understanding is that he was acting independently of the two groups, and in fact, you'll see in Harper's, he's the arbiter. Dick Cheney is the man who sets energy policy in the United States. He is the kind of energy president. And he is the one that I'm told basically is the ringmaster who said, okay, first it's the State Department plan, now it's the neocon plans are on top because Rumsfeld did such a good job with the military action, and now there's been too many problems and we are going back to the oil industry's ideas of what must occur. So he's kind of look at him that way. He's not part of either group, but the arbiter between them. Do we have the reason why that Bob Ebel says, now, just so you know who he is, Ebel, E-B-E-L, he's with now with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, you know, your real big establishment think tank, but he was a CIA oil expert. He was the guy who was the expert to the Pentagon and Wolfowitz before the war on oil, giving them the numbers. As he put it, he said, up to the invasion, the purpose of the invasion was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. He said, the day after the invasion, it's about the oil. And that's the way to think about it. Once they had Iraq, now what do you do with it? And when you have Iraq, you have two things. You not only have Iraq's oil, and here's the crucial part. We now own a seat on OPEC. Through our control of Iraq's oil, and we do control it, we control a seat on OPEC, and we can use that seat to destroy OPEC, or we can use that seat to bolster OPEC, and it's choice B that was made by Dick Cheney.
So is this really, does this conflict between, you know, that you characterize as being between the neocons and big oil, does this indicate more of the, you know, kind of rudderless ship narrative here? Is this part of, you know, the reason they screwed up so badly?
Well, I mean, according to the guys close to the oil industry, this is why they screwed up so badly, which is the original plan was in and out in 3 days. You bring in the 82nd Airborne, you have a coup d'etat, nothing changes. This has been like coup d'etats in Iraq past that the U.S. has been involved in and, or endorsed. And nothing changes except the guy who was giving us a pain in the rear. And it is the feeling of some oil industry people, State Department people, that the neocons bit off one too many by trying to remake Iraq, which required a massive occupation, privatizing, that is, kind of piecing off and selling off their assets, parachuting in a guy like Ahmed Chalabi, that the oil industry, by the way, I've had four people in the oil industry say that his administration was more corrupt than Saddam's. They're very upset by this idea. And then the game of trying to privatize the fields, which, as Falah al-Jabouri said, who was in on the original planning of the invasion a la State Department, the quick hit, he said, you know, this discussion of privatization, which, believe me, it hit the streets of Baghdad, and he said that is one of the main things that pushed the insurgency. They thought that, you know, to Iraqis, this is all they have is their oil, and that these foreign billionaires, Iraqi exiles and big oil companies, are just going to steal everything in sight, and that they were stealing the legacy of Iraq, and that they had to protect their nation and its resource from outside theft.
But you say Wolfowitz lost, and you made it sound as if he lost kind of early on. Now it sounds more like, you know, it took them months to really resolve this, and meanwhile Iraq was dissolving into chaos.
That's exactly right. And my information is that people like, well, I spoke to Phil Caruso, the ex-CEO of Shell. Phil Carroll. C-A-R-R-O-L-L, Phil Carroll. And, you know, there was this major problem, but my understanding is that McKee was looking at fields on fire, massive insurgency, reaction against these remake and privatization plan, reaction against a carpetbagger like Chalabi, and so it took a long time to get back to plan A, but now, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. They'd already set this nation on fire.
Can we put a date on when we were back to plan A for sure?
Well, you know, again, it's a warring process. And in fact, I should mention that the closing words to me from Falah al-Jabouri, that's A-L-J-I-B-U-R-Y, is his fear that Chalabi may be back with these plans again based on his recent agreement with the religious leaders who won the last Shiite leaders who won the last election.
So the narrative is maybe these bozos just can't get their story straight even now.
Well, they can't now, but never bet against the Saudis, OPEC, and big oil in the United States. And ultimately, I think you could say that by January of 2004, when this secret report on reframing the Iraqi oil industry was finalized. You could say that that was really the capstone of the turning back to control by the State Department establishment. People like Negroponte coming in. We know that Garner was fired because the neocons didn't like his position. He was replaced by Bremer, who carried the neocons' water. Bremer was, despite what the our local papers say, was pretty much booted out in favor of again the establishment pro oil company guy Negroponte. So that's kind of the inside back and forth. So the return of Negroponte into position as ambassador there, our chief man, the completion of the studies, returning, making sure that the state oil company is recreated in Iraq.
But in the meantime, we had, for example, debathification of the army,
right,
and the total catastrophe that resulted.
Well, one thing that's very interesting is that the Garner is, for those if you remember General Jay Garner, who I'm also interviewed for BBC. In fact, you might want to see that report as well, which you can see on my website, the original report we did with Jay Garner. Is that the oil industry, was not happy about privatization from the beginning. Either was Garner. The establishment people thought that this was a disaster. And debathification, Bremer and his debathification, was part of that crazy process. I should note that Phil Carroll of Shell, when he came in to Baghdad, he was flown in on a C-17, and he told Bremer, look, you're not going to privatize anything on my watch, period. He also told Bremer that, at least according to Carroll, that that this debathification doesn't apply to the oil ministry. It wasn't going to apply to him. They had some serious oil guys, who may have been wearing Saddam badges, but, that wasn't going to apply to them. So that was a major disaster. In addition, but then, of course, Chalabi came in and removed some of those Baathists from the oil ministry because it got in the way of his alleged thieving cronies. But then Chalabi and his characters were removed and the Baathist technocrats were returned to power.
All right, well, I'll say one more thing and I'll give up my spot. Thank you very much, Greg. I suggest as an overall narrative that Bush is such a weak leader that he let everything be fragmented and there was no one plan.
Well, I have to say that, I can't say how your narrative should be, but I can tell you that it starts out with a coup d'etat, militarized coup d'etat being planned by the State Department, which becomes full-scale invasion by neocons and remaking Iraq in its image and grabbing the oil, smashing OPEC, and that plan gets reversed. And once again, we have a big oil on top, OPEC on top, and the State Department back on top, but the neocons out in the wilderness. I mean, it's only in Bush world that a nomination to the presidency of the World Bank is really a demotion, but that's clearly what's happened to Paul Wolfowitz. He's being pulled out of policy and being sent to go, deal with the vaccinations in mud huts.
Thank you. I'm going back on mute.
Jeff Staples, RadioLeft.com. Greg, I've been thinking about this a little bit, and it occurs to me that in reality, remember Bush sitting in the classroom looking dazed when 9/11 occurred?
Yes.
It seems to me that maybe the reason that he was dazed was because he saw his life going before his eyes, in that he figured, oh no, my presidency's over because I have completely ignored all this stuff I was told to take care of and I was too busy shoveling garbage on my ranch. So then the plan that they came up with was this shock and awe, terrorize the hell out of people in this country, and so on, really to distract people from the fact that Bush wasn't doing his job, and that's why 9/11 occurred.
Well, I have, that gets into a different topic from the Iraq story, except that if you go back, ignoring the information before 9/11 is another story, of course, we did on BBC television. That was pretty roundly ignored in the United States, but led BBC News was the killing off the investigation of the Bin Laden family before September 11th. And, it's not a question of conspiring to allow an attack on the United States. It is evidence that these guys had their eyes shut while they were off on their cavorts of of trying to kill the caribou in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve and go after Saddam.
What I'm suggesting, I suppose, is if they weren't in such a panic to save George Bush's presidency, they might have concocted a better plan to steal the oil.
You know, one of the things that I want to be careful of is I don't know if it's a plan to steal. Remember, the idea is, and I think that Lewis Lapham, who's the editor of Harper's, and who, by the way, comes from a notable petroleum family, it is not about getting oil. It's about the price of oil. The industry is not concerned about supply anywhere near as much as it is concerned about the price. The industry is not looking for oil. It's looking to control the flow of oil and its price. Therefore, the big threats, you know, the oil industry does not want to own Iraq's oil. It does want to control Iraq's production so that it doesn't undermine OPEC and undermine this extraordinary avalanche of cash, which has resulted from the war in Iraq and other problems worldwide, and they don't want to see that undercut. I mean, you know, in a very honest manner, as Amy Jaffe of the Baker Institute put it, if I were an oil company executive, I wouldn't exactly be crying over high oil prices, and they don't. And I think Phil Carroll said of Shell said, you know, one of the most straightforward things I've ever heard. He said, you know, oil companies don't have a philosophy. We don't have a theology. We care about the bottom line. And so, therefore, they don't care about privatization, grabbing oil, et cetera. They care about the price of oil and how it affects their bottom line.
Well, let me go back to that. It was, you know, was the war about oil or not, in the sense that, did you know, when they were first coming up with their plan to invade Iraq, what was their motive originally in the weeks after Bush took the White House in January 2001?
Okay. Powell, again. You know, you're asking me to reach into the mind of George Bush, which is a very tiny space to crawl into, if you don't mind the image. I don't want to reach into his mind or Dick Cheney's mind or anything. I do want to tell you what they did, which is whatever their motives were, oil was never far from their thinking. Phil Carroll told me he was called in, you know, a good half year before the invasion to plan and advise what to do with Iraq's oil. Fala al-Jabouri, when he talks about these early meetings within weeks of the inauguration of Bush, the first inauguration, he said that the meetings quickly became an oil group. I mean, that's what they're talking about. When you're talking about Iraq, you're not talking about a broccoli farm. You're talking about an oil nation and a member of OPEC, with the second highest reserves following only Saudi Arabia. So oil was never far from their mind. In fact, as we note at the top of the BBC film, and in my film Bush Family Fortunes, is that, you know, Ari Fleischer kept calling it Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL, which of course Karl Rove made sure was changed to Operation Iraqi Freedom, OIF. So oil was never far from their minds. What motivated them, I don't know. But were they thinking of the oil while they were thinking of whatever else? Absolutely. They couldn't get the oil off their mind, and it was just a tussle about what you do with the oil and what you do with the seat on OPEC. That was in their minds from day one. Any other questions?
Jeff Staples, RadioLeft.com again. It seems to me then that what you're really saying, Greg Palast, is that what they cared about is continuing the flow of oil to the United States as the supplies decline so that our economy would not be destroyed. And as you pointed out, that has nothing to do with the actual ownership of the oil, but it does have to do with having sufficient control of the area that they can guarantee that flow at the price they want.
I would respectfully disagree with that interpretation. Stop thinking of the United States and start thinking of big oil. Big oil has no borders. It has no flag. It doesn't have a location, and it doesn't give a flying... it doesn't give a flying bagel about the United States economy or whether we have a supply of oil whatsoever. Okay, this is about OPEC and control of oil prices. In fact, the nightmare for, just so you understand, that the neocons were concerned about supply, but that was for the purpose of smashing OPEC. The neocon plan of privatization, behind it, just so you understand, which is crafted at the Heritage Foundation, the crafters of the plan explained that if you privatize the fields, there'll be competition to ramp up production to 6 million barrels a day from the 2 million now over the OPEC quota, which will destroy OPEC, which will bring down the price of oil, destroy OPEC, and obviously open up floods of supply for the world, not just particularly the United States. The oil companies don't want supply any more than a potato farmer wants a sudden new supply of potatoes to hit the market. So it's not that they want supply, they want to control and stop supply. That's how they make money. OPEC is not in the business of getting you oil. The reason there's a cartel is to stop you from getting oil. That's the whole point of a cartel. So the plan now is not to increase the supply. In fact, and indeed, let me quote you from Ed Morris. And now Morris is one of the most important oil industry lobbyists in the country. And he said the vice president, the vice president's office has not pursued, and I'm quoting Morris, the vice president's office has not pursued a policy in Iraq that would lead to a rapid opening of the Iraqi oil energy sector. But they have not done anything, either with producers or energy policy, that would put us on track to say we're going to put the squeeze on OPEC. In other words, the oil industry is saying that the vice president, who's in charge of energy policy, does not want to open the floodgates, does not want to increase the supply of oil. In fact, he's made a big point, Dick Cheney, of not even opening up our own strategic petroleum reserve, which is what Bill Clinton did to hammer down the price of oil when OPEC got out of line. So it's not about, it's only in terms of supply, not to supply the United States, because these guys don't give it a toss if the United States, you know, implodes. What they do care about is the price of oil.
So really, then, I gave them too much credit by thinking that they were doing some long-term planning when really all they're interested in is short-term greed.
As well, I don't know, as like I say, as Phil Carroll said, the oil company's concerns, and again, he's the former CEO of Shell USA, the only concern of an oil company executive is the bottom line, we have no theology. And that's the crucial point here. It's the bottom line here, and our vice president is affectionate towards the bottom line of these guys. Now, you know, I mean, he may have some strong, good policy reasons why that is so, but you know, he's not picking up the phone to my calls. Next question, if any.
Greg, this is Carolyn Kay in Chicago.
Hey, Carolyn.
How are you doing? How does the concept of peak oil fit into this situation, or if you know?
I don't think it fits into the situation at all, except that, you know, whether there are some who say that we are hitting a peak in our oil production and some who say that that's nonsense. The point of OPEC is to make sure that the price of oil is kept high no matter what the situation. If we were running out of oil, then we wouldn't need OPEC, or the oil companies wouldn't need OPEC. Their biggest problem right now is not that we're running out of oil, but that we have too much. That's why we have a cartel. Remember that it was only a few years ago that oil was at $8 a barrel. And that's not because there's too little, but because there was too much. That's why you have a cartel with quotas to keep supply out of the marketplace. And so we have to go back to the idea that oil companies are concerned with price and the bottom line and not supplying oil to anyone. The high price of oil in the United States has probably cost the United States 1 million jobs so far, this current run-up to oil, by the calculations of the OECD. So that's the issue, is the price. Next question. No more questions?
Jim Bryant, Democrats.com.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, Greg, have you researched the fact that people in the Bush administration, either via Cheney or via Rumsfeld, may have leaked parts of the Iraq plan within DOD even before the election was decided by the Supreme Court? I was working at a DOD facility in Y2K, and by late November or early December, as I recall, there were already rumors floating about invading Iraq. And I recall this may have been about the same time that the pre-inauguration reports on Rumsfeld's goals for the Quadrennial Review were starting to come out in the press, and the facility I was at would have been key to that review, thus they will have been in contact with those people.
Now, you're talking about before the 2000 race.
No, I'm talking after the election, but prior to inauguration.
But prior to the inauguration.
Yeah, about the same time Rumsfeld's goals were coming out.
I should mention that according to our insiders, that while there was a, you know, formal meetings were convened by the State Department to plan the invasion of Iraq within weeks of the inauguration, that the thinking and discussion about these meetings, they didn't just like say, hey, here's a good idea, why don't we get together? The meetings, by the way, were held in California, Washington, London, and the Mideast. And that didn't happen overnight, that type of planning, that there was, in fact, according to our insiders, discussion during the Bush campaign. Like, you know, what do we do once we got that White House, what do we do with it? So obviously the discussion was going forth, and, you know, who was flapping their lips and leaking it out into the DOD, I don't know. Maybe someone did so strategically to try to win over some of the hawkish types within the DOD, or at least let them know that a lot more money would therefore be on the way. Now that's a speculation. I don't know. I can tell you that these guys were from jump planning an invasion. Now let me just close and say that if you want to read the report, it's out in Harper's Magazine today. We have additional information from BBC. You can watch the BBC television program at gregpalast.com. I know that we've had some technical problems at BBC for non-UK viewers trying to get it on the net, but it is up at democracynow.org, and it's up at the gregpalast.com site. And I'll be, blogging it to add a little more information to make a little more trouble and adding some more facts.
Is it possible to get one more question?
Ooh. I was hoping to get two.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hello, Greg. This is Bill Moyer from the Backbone Campaign.
Okay.
Curious, for those of us who are engaged more in movement building and progressive, trying to find a way to get troops out of, get U.S. out of Iraq and put the priorities on a different kind of agenda, what can we learn from this besides possibly what we imagine as a united front of neocons and oilmen is not such a united front? Is there something else to be gleaned from this for the movement building purposes?
I'm not here to build a movement, but I am here to give you the info. So what would you glean from this? You glean more than that there's a fight between neocons and oil companies, though that's very important to know that the right wing and the kind of ruling elite are not some type of monolithic structure, but that they have their backstabbing, backbiting, you know, and greedy little set-tos. But that is more than backroom tussling that I'm reporting here. I'm telling you that your government is lying to you, okay, in a systematic, dangerous manner. That they have been conducting secret plans for secret wars that they don't tell you about while denying it in public. But let's not forget that that when our president took the oath of office in January of 2001, he said that we were going to end nation building and redoing the face of the political character of other people's countries, while he's hosting meetings to attack Iraq. Once the Iraq was on the table, we were told it has nothing to do with oil. While they are bringing in guys from Shell Oil, ConocoPhillips, and everyone else is getting in there, slicing up, figuring out what to do with other people's oil. We also had then secret when the oil companies were unhappy, again, secret government planning what to do now with Iraq's oil. So you have a secret plan crafted by the neocons, overthrown by another secret plan crafted in a way that's pleasing to the to big oil and OPEC, and so what you have here is basically a government running in secret, planning secret wars, planning secret dispositions of other people's oil. And let me tell you, as one of the players in this said, it's not minor. People have died over this. The goofy privatization, oil privatization plan has led to death in the field. It added tremendously to the insurgency in Iraq, because now these people were fighting for their national legacy. And so it's not a minor issue that these guys are running a kind of secret government operation in which they're playing with oil. And also it's very important to know that in the midst of this secret policymaking and this secret skullduggery, that we have an administration which is doing its level best to support the activities of an oil cartel which is devastating our economy and the world's economy, all being done hidden away from the TV cameras, hidden away from view. And now, even though we've reported on BBC, it's what I call, it's hidden in plain sight. That is, it's simply not covered in the U.S. press. And then everyone wonders why the British public and the European public and the Latin American public have a different view of reality than Americans. That's because they get news of the reality.
This is Brad Friedman from BradBlog. Greg, we met a few weeks ago up at the Freedom Cinema Festival. But I'm actually asking a question for Larissa Alexandrovna, who from Raw Story, who's on the call, but she's under the weather and her voice is shot, and so she wanted me to ask you if you have any idea what level Sir Mark Moody Stewart was involved on the Cheney secret energy meetings and how intimately he was involved.
That's an easy one to answer. I don't know. Judicial Watch, has sued to get the names of the people in those meetings. By the way, we've sued, and Judicial Watch is going, not sued, Judicial Watch is prepared to sue on behalf of Harper's and BBC to get this report, which is, and I want to thank them, that's how, one of the reasons we were able to get the report. Terrific research work by Lenny von Eckert, our researcher here, but we needed a good threat, the legal threat, to carry over something. And they're still, by the way, denying. If it weren't for insiders who didn't realize that they were giving us information, we wouldn't have even known who put together this report. They are still completely stum on the State Department on who created this, how it was created, etc. They simply won't divulge what's happening with, they're not going to give us the minutes of the secret government.
This is Bob Furtick again. The picture you're describing of the oil industry supporting these remarkably high prices for oil is having a devastating impact on the American economy. It's also putting General Motors on the brink of bankruptcy because they built all these SUVs and people can't afford high gasoline prices and they can't afford big SUVs anymore. In this situation, why are we not hearing outrage from American businesses? I'm not even talking about American consumers who aren't given a voice and aren't allowed to be heard. But why aren't the American businesses that are suffering, why aren't they being heard expressing outrage over what the oil industry is doing to the U.S. economy?
That's a very good question. And I can't speak for the National Association of Manufacturers. I guess they're too busy trying to take away your health insurance and family leave and, eliminating the minimum wage so that they have little time to deal with the things that are actually putting them out of business, like high oil prices. There is obviously a huge split between industrial America, the interests of the last little bits of industrial America and both high finance and oil. So, I can't answer that except to say that obviously we saw that, again, that's a factional split within the Bush administration. Paul O'Neill, who was one of the last of the metal benders with any influence in the Bush administration, who was Secretary of State, was, of course, bounced out of the cabinet on his keister because he objected to policies which were ruinous to manufacturing in the United States. So manufacturing obviously has very little sway with the president from Texas, who is much closer to petroleum, high finance, which is doing very well through this massive shift in the petrodollars around the world, and manufacturing is absolutely getting the short end of the stick. Of course, we seem to be solving that by simply exporting manufacturing industries to other countries.
Okay, any more questions?
Yes, actually. This is Rob Pennegy with Realityque.com.
Okay.
I just had one question about the transition from the State Department plan to the Pentagon plan.
Yes.
We know the Pentagon plan, or Rumsfeld, I think according to Woodward, asked for a plan from Tommy Franks right at the end of the Battle of Tora Bora.
That's
how
right.
Do you have any idea how we got from the State Department plan to the development of the Pentagon plan, and was the State Department plan somehow shelved? Did Rumsfeld
yes.
have extra influence? Or
yes, well, in fact, you got your timing, you know, that timing is what I had, too. I mean, what Woodward had was that suddenly out of nowhere, that the right wing and its plan for attack on the neocons, their plan for attack on Iraq came after September 11th, around the time of the Afghan war. And that is exactly the information I also got from General Jay Garner. What we've added now is that there actually was a plan of attack from the first days of the administration developed by the State Department, that the neocon plan was the one that that took over. My understanding is that the neocon plan, Rumsfeld's plan, had authority because of his successes in Afghanistan and later the military successes of the initial invasion in Baghdad. That cemented it all in place. There was a tendency to paper over differences. The naming of Jay Garner, who is from the establishment, to be our first occupation chieftain, the first viceroy of Iraq, was a kind of victory for the State Department's establishment. But obviously, since he wouldn't go along with it, he told me he was handed these plans, these neocon privatization plans. And he just said there is just no way he was going to jam this down the throat of the Iraqis, mainly because he's an old Iraqian and saw that would lead to, you're going to have to, but you're not going to impose this plan unless you got enough troops here to enforce it at the point of a gun.
Right.
So what's happened is that there was, but the timing, I would agree. I don't think Woodward is apparently aware of the State Department plans, because he was listening to the people excusing Colin Powell by saying, well, the State Department really didn't even want an invasion. That's just not true. But obviously, around the time of the Afghan war, the neocons ended up with the policy upper hand.
Right. Is it clear that Garner was ousted directly because of rejecting the privatization plan? I know your previous report had it implied that, but it wasn't clear to me from what he said that's exactly what happened.
Well, two things. Number one, Garner would not even say that he was fired.
Okay.
No one wants to say that they are fired. I don't think there's a writer, journalist, or policy person on the planet who doesn't recognize that Jay Garner was given the old heave-ho.
Right.
He did tell me where his disagreements with Mr. Rumsfeld and gang came, which were, one, over privatization, especially of the oil field, and two, over his demand for swift elections within 90 days of the toppling of Saddam. Remember, this is before when they really were, I mean, Iraqis weren't throwing flowers, as Wolfowitz had suggested, but they were pretty happy to get rid of Saddam. There was not an insurgency at the time, and we hadn't put in a character like Chalabi in as our puppet potentate, and therefore there was an opportunity for a quick election. And he had called for what he called the big tent meeting of the leaders of Iraq to plan for that quick election, and then he got the heave-ho. So, which of these items gave him the heave-ho, I don't know. But, his resistance to privatization, his demand for elections, obviously made him an unpopular man, and obviously conflicted with the documents that he knew, that he did recognize the documents that we handed him and said, yeah, this is what he was getting.
If I could ask just one brief question, do you have any idea when, if he hadn't been given the heave-ho, as you say, when he was? Do you have any idea how long he was supposed to be in place otherwise?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, all these guys, just like Bremer was given the heave-ho, but he would say, he left at the appropriate time. So, in other words, all this was open. I don't think that Garner went in with an open-ended remit. He was told that at some point, he obviously this wouldn't be a job he'd have forever.
and that he would be replaced at some point. But obviously, being replaced the night you arrive in Baghdad is literally the night he arrived in Baghdad, he was
right.
fired,
right.
Removed. One would have to say that that was a, I guess a charitable way to put it, is premature exit.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, was there one more question?
Yeah, this is Jeff Staples again with RadioLeft.com. Greg, would you summarize by giving us a brief chronological timeline of the key points in these issues?
Okay. Within weeks of the Bush inauguration in 2001, meetings began to plan for the invasion of Iraq and the overthrow of Saddam, engineered by the State Department, hosted by the State Department and the National Security Council. It was a plan for a militarized coup d'etat, the Ba'athists stay in power. Then, following September 11th and the rise of the authority of the neocons and the victories in Afghanistan, a new plan was created to remake the entire Mideast, of which the invasion of Iraq was part of the story. At that time, a 101-page document was crafted. We have a February 2002 draft of it, calling for the privatization and the remake of the entire economy of Iraq, including the privatization of all of the oil assets, all the oil fields of
Iraq.
Excuse
me?
Yes.
2003.
Excuse me, 2003. That was my research. Hello?
Go ahead.
Lenny von Eckert. I got to be very careful about these dates. So, right, so the Afghan War, remember, was the end of 2001. By February 2003, we had the plan. Over 2002, they were having the meetings, Pentagon, State, and everyone developing these plans. Then we had Jay Garner put into place by, Lenny, help me with this because I'm not looking at my timelines, by the time he arrives in Baghdad, I believe it was April of 2003, the night he arrives, Garner is fired because he does not want to, you know, he was resisting, whatever their reasons were, he was resisting privatization and calling for elections. You can't, by the way, have elections if you're going to privatize the nation's oil fields because no elected government is going to go along with it. That's, you understand the conflict between democracy and privatization, which is that Iraqis wouldn't put up with it. So you could not hold elections while you were trying to sell off their assets. So there's a delay in elections, there's an attempt to grab the oil fields, there's a de-Ba'athification, and all this leads to a massive explosion and insurgency. Phil Carroll of Shell Oil is sent in to try to run the oil situation, but it's getting out of hand. He asked to be replaced by Bob McKee of ConocoPhillips Corporation, who had just retired from there and was the chairman of a Halliburton subsidiary. The Conoco Halliburton guy says enough is enough, calls for a new oil regime. A secret formal study is put together by the State Department under the guidance of Amy Jaffe, the James Baker Institute, which lays out various state oil company profiles. And in the meantime, the neocon plan is now out, and that means the wider program of trying to smash OPEC. Oil prices are rising. The Jaffe plan, which is the study begins in December of 2003 and is completed in January 2004. It was a very, very quick policy coup d'etat, is the way to put it. So the oil company OPEC policy coup d'etat is completed by January 2004. And of course in this period of time, by May, Bremer is ousted and a new regime is placed, and we have the so-called election. So there's your timeline.
Now, Greg, I do have one question about it, and that is, you talked about planning starting in December 2000, January 2001, and then the next thing that you mentioned was the report in February of 2002.
2003.
2003. So there was nothing that was visible between January 2001 and February 2003?
No. At the according to Garner and others, the plan, the neocon plan for the privatization and takeover of Iraq's assets, and obviously the invasion that would require that, began after September and after the military successes of the Afghan war. That's when the neocons suddenly had high stock with the president and vice president and could start, you know, making their new plans.
So that's different planning from what they were doing in December, January of 2001.
In 2001, remember, January of 2001 is the inauguration of the president. That's the State Department plan for invasion, which is 3 days of martial law, in and out, a coup d'etat, backed by the U.S. military. And basically, that's kind of on the model of the Dominican Republic, take over Haiti,
Venezuela.
Yeah, well, or the attempt in Venezuela, certainly, Grenada invasion, et cetera. In other words, we have a quick militarized coup d'etat.
And staying with that for just a moment then, you said that this was going on even before Bush was inaugurated, but it was hosted by the State Department. That seems a little bit contradictory.
No. Now let me clarify that. The first meetings hosted by the State Department, in fact, the name is Pam Quanrud, Quanrud, who is now at our embassy in Moscow with the State Department. So she was the coordinator for the National Security Council and the State Department. So the official hosting by our government began within the weeks after the inauguration. The people who participated in those meetings were, of course, discussing it beforehand, just as the neocons are discussing, you know, kicking Saddam in the teeth back, you know, publishing that, making their public noises about it back in 98. So were the State Department-related teams. They were already had their eyes on this, but of course they didn't have any official authority until after the inauguration.
So really, then what happened was there was planning by the Bushies or the neocons prior to January 20th, and then after January 20th, they came in and presented to the State Department what they wanted.
Or the State Department convened them, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's not clear who made the first calls. That I don't know who called whom. All I know is that, and again, you know, there's no question that both sides, all through this period, no matter who was on top or bottom, kept working away at their competing plans. But again, we start out with State on top, right after the inauguration, and the quick hit in the oil, and which is very favorable, a plan which, of course, is favorable to the oil companies. They don't want a big, messy business in Iraq, and they don't want privatization. It is only after Afghanistan that we now have official creation of the plans for privatization and remaking Iraq into a little, Chile on the Tigris.
Okay. Greg, I want to thank you. This has been fascinating. We're going to get hold of today's Harper's Magazine. We're going to learn the details, what you're talking about. I assume you'll continue covering this story.
Yeah.
We're going to try and get the bloggers to cover it more. Mm-hmm. And
I should add one thing. I do apologize for this one being one of the most complex stories I've ever done.
Well, that's
but
okay.
I can't do anything about that. If you want the kind of as simple as we can render it, you can get the BBC story on my website, including the film and the transcripts and the BBC write-up. Get a little bit more in Harper's. We do have an RSS feed as of this week that you can, clip onto. And, if it weren't, and I have to say, if it weren't for the bloggers, my reports for BBC television, again, my only disagreement with the introduction is I am mainstream. It's America which is out of the mainstream. You know, the Washington Post and the New York Times, God bless them, are basically little metropolitan papers. And they are out of the mainstream of the international press. And so, so what I appreciate that the bloggers have done, and I appreciate your work, is that you are bringing mainstream, hard, investigative, and important reporting
to America, which is denied it by these parochial, little, closed-minded outlets.
Well, that's a ringing endorsement. We thank you for that, and we're going to give this to Jeff Staples at Radio Left, who's going to take us out for the next minute.
And again, thank you, Bob Burdick. I want to thank Bob Burdick from Democrats.com, Greg Palast from GregPalast.com, and I do want to, I'm going to differ with by taking the last word on this one, Greg. I think they are actually corporate media, and they may be little small-town parochial newspaper, but it's really corporate media that has an agenda. Anyway, we're going to close this program, and we'll be back next week with another issue of Blog Call.